Welcome to the Productivity Podcast. This is the third episode in our series around top right thinking, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Dr. Ian Price, coach, trainer, author, speaker, amongst many things. Morning, how are you?
I'm very well, Simon. Great to be with you today. And I'm excited, having listened to the previous two podcasts, and slightly daunted at the quality. So let's see what we can do.
No, I'm sure it'll be amazing, as per the previous two with Dulcy. So do you want to give us a bit of background, Ian, in terms of who you are, what you've done, and probably just to join the dots for the listeners, how you know Dulcy and are engaged in the top right thinking model?
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I said, my name's Ian Price. I'm a neuroscientist by training. So I did a degree and PhD in neuroscience before then going on to work with the BBC on their Human Mind Outreach program. So I did a postdoc research as well. And I just found that actually I far preferred being out talking about science and connecting the dots, literally, for people, helping people to connect the dots so that they can have autonomy in how they make decisions and how they interpret the world. And that kind of led to, via a spell of being their stay-at-home dad, to working with all sorts of people, charities, companies, about how people unlock, release, and elevate their thinking. And sometimes that's about confidence. Sometimes that's about focus. Sometimes that's about breaking through rate-limiting beliefs and barriers. And as a result, now I'm very fortunate, I work with a company, including Dulcy and I work together in many different ways, and I can explain how we got to meet, but we work in different ways with different companies. So I work with, as through them and as my own company, Think It Out, a number of associates that I have with my company. We work with all sorts of people, work with sort of step-up startup companies. We look at big corporations. We look at charities. We look at non-for-profits. We work with teams and leaders, really to help teams lead, or leaders to lead and teams to team, basically. That's kind of the sort of bottom line. We work with elite athletes, Paralympians, Olympians, and transition from a life in professional sport, as well as then through to a life outside of professional sport. And I find it a great privilege. I really, really, really enjoy it. The more I speak with people, the more I work as a coach, one-to-one coach with people, I team coach, that's coaching executive teams. I also group coach, so that's sort of often on training programs. So a lot of my training is really group coaching. And then, you know, I'm just blown away by the impact that being curious and asking curious questions, top right questions, can really unlock, and I said, release and elevate thinking and leadership and teaming. And that's what I do. That's what I do now, and as well as writing about it and speaking about it at conferences and wherever I get an opportunity, and things like this podcast.
Excellent. Sounds like you've got an amazing and varied kind of bunch of associates and clients to work with. So it kind of keeps you on your toes, I suspect.
100%. And absolutely. And if we get to talk about sort of psychometrics and sort of behavioral preferences, you'll understand I'm tiggerish, one. I'm very curious, and I just love the variety of it. So no day, no week is the same. And particularly now that we're able to travel again, you know, sort of traveling to Ireland or all sorts of parts of the UK and Europe, doing this is just, again, it's a privilege. I love doing it.
Excellent. And Dulcy's probably a fairly similar character, having got to know her. So how did you meet Dulcy, and how does that work?
We're very similar. I didn't think I'd ever meet somebody that would be quite as tiggerish and excitable and curious and vivacious, I suppose, certainly on stage. So I met Dulcy through the first lockdowns. We just happened to work for the same provider, and I read her first book, It's Not Blue Rocket Science. I loved it. I genuinely loved it. And I was listening back to the podcast, and she was worried about how I might have been contacting her. And I thought that was interesting. She thought she might be an imposter. But I contacted her to say, again, you know, with the work that I did with the BBC in particular, and working with what we called sort of disaffected audiences, audiences that don't feel that they've got anything to contribute to science, which is one of my sort of passions. Absolutely, everybody has something to contribute. Everybody can be an experimenter, somebody who wants to understand the world and contextualize the world so that they can actually do more for themselves and for other people. And so, yeah, just reached out to Dulcy, recognizing some of those same traits in the book, and said how much I loved it. And there began a number of conversations that ended up with us doing in 2021 a series of, well, essentially Instagram Lives. Every week we would look at a well-being trait that was science-backed that cost virtually no money, no money or virtually no money. And when we say money, we're talking about investment of, say, a tennis ball, and required very little time in the day. And the idea was that everybody could have the opportunity to raise their ability to have well-being through raising really sort of four brain chemicals: dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins, which we might get talked to about later. And that was it. And we just set ourselves the challenge of doing that every week. And that then became essentially, you know, a blog, which then became a book, which is Dose. And, you know, from that, again, we've constantly sort of challenging each other about, okay, what's the application of that? Does that really stack up? How does that really work in real life? And I know that Dulcie's mentioned, and, you know, on the previous podcast, the work that we've been doing together with you and Sue about how, you know, with a particular big client, about how does that impact productivity? How does that impact engagement, motivation, and retention within an organization? How can we actually release more by being us or we? So Dulcie and I are very similar, and we will bump alongside each other several times. Again, because we have similar groups that we work with, we also work with each other's companies. And it's just, again, it's a joy. It's a joy to have somebody like that to sort of ping off. And as you can tell, I'm almost pinging off my chair just talking about it.
Excellent. So, as you know, in the first kind of two episodes, we talked about the four box model. We talked about potentially always, you know, striving to be top right as much as you can. But, you know, realistically, we're all going to bounce around the four, because that's life and emotion. And if we put ourselves in the world of leaders, whether that be in a restaurant, in an office, in a factory, in a retail environment, wherever that might be, there's a huge level of complexity in terms of, I suppose, the systems, the processes, but also the cross-generational span of colleagues and employees that you're dealing with that have different requirements that people are having to process every day. So that must really challenge that ability to stay in the top right.
Absolutely. And it's also the place where we can flip that and see opportunity. So what you're alluding to here is the idea of wicked problems. So those are problems that are very difficult to get a grapple on. We're not talking about wicked problems as in evil problems. We're talking about problems that are really tricky. And why are they tricky? Well, it's usually to do with very little data, or data that's contradictory, or information data that ultimately is changing all the time, and without necessarily people understanding what the outcome might be. And one of the hardest things, I think, certainly 21st century, is the pace of change and the pace that companies, teams have to respond. And I mean, the term was really sort of came from the 60s and 70s from sort of social management kind of point of view. But it basically means that any one of us trying to just use our own brain are unlikely to be able to solve these problems. And even I would suggest, and I would say this as a human, AI, I still think will still, at the moment at least, have a problem to try and deal with that, because they're still limited by the way in which we program AI and set AI up. And the best way, we believe still, is to be able to challenge each other. And so it's basically through collaboration. So collaborating with each other. And how do you collaborate with each other? Well, you need to have that high level of trust so that you can then challenge each other with good disagreement. And this is a really sort of tagging onto a model which a guy called Patrick Lencioni did a book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which is really a fable about how teams don't interact well. And one of the things that they need to interact well is to have high trust, so that they can then have, which is this high, you know, support that Dulcie's been talking to us about, so that we can then have good disagreement or conflict. And conflict, the root of conflict is not to fight. The root of conflict is have two opposing ideas. And that really, in the purest sense, is doing science. That's what science is about, saying I have this thesis, this idea, and well, my thesis, my idea, my evidence is over here. And that leads to this magic place of then, through collaboration with high trust, with high challenge, you get to this place of commitment and committing to a solution as far as we see it right now. Ideally, that incorporates something called agile working, where we have sprints. So we chunk it down and we work out, okay, we're going to have a go at this and we're going to set ourselves a time limit. And again, this is not trying to get to a place where you feel that that sort of staging post is the answer. It is a part of the direction of travel to unravel wicked and challenging problems and having it at pace. And then the other part that then leads to, and again, this is just going up Lencioni's pyramid, is saying, well, actually, then you get accountability. If you can have accountability within the team, because you've got this high trust, because you're not afraid to challenge things, because you are able to have that in an open way, it means that you're committed to things. And that means that actually it's easy to call each other out on, okay, are we doing this? Are you doing this? Are we doing this? And that ultimately leads to quicker results, which then fits in nicely to this idea people might have come across in terms of it's a growth mindset. You know, the idea of then being able to act at pace, to fail fast and to fail forwards. And that all comes, that's all comes together then in how we use each other's brains to unlock, release and elevate our thinking so we can connect the dots and get to good enough or best fit solutions for wicked problems.
So there's a couple of bits just to circle back around on there, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of the pieces around the team and the trust and the challenge reminded me of Matthew Syed's book, Rebel Ideas.
Yes.
Which I don't know if you've read, I would assume you have. But clearly the premise is around surrounding yourself with people that will provide that challenge, because you get much better results than surrounding yourself with like-minded people who all nod and say, isn't that brilliant? Well done. Let's all go out for a beer or a kind of cup of coffee. So that 100%. That kind of resonates there. And then the high performance bit comes back to some of the kind of Jake Humphries podcast, the high performance podcast, because that is the, I suppose, core of most of their conversation around fail fast, learn. And clearly all the people they speak to have been very successful in their line of work and business or whatever it is they do. So they're two good references, I think, for people listening if they've not read or listened to those
absolutely
podcasts.
And if you want another one, I mean, obviously Carol Dweck's done the whole thing on growth mindset, and it's definitely for younger listeners, they would have had this in school ad infinitum. Again, one of the things I do with teams is particularly younger teams who have come across growth mindset and Carol Dweck's idea about, it's really about one's attitude to learning and praise. And really, as you said, saying is surrounding yourself with challenge and being excited about challenge and to value the effort through challenge rather than necessarily the outcome that's so important here. And the thing that was, what I love working with teams is that quite often people give me the right answer, inverted commas, about what growth mindset is. And then I set them a number of challenges, and within 30 seconds, fun challenges, I hasten to add, within 30 seconds, I'm hearing, I'm useless, I can't do this, we'll never get there. And it's really, again, working through that pain, it's through that challenge, and being then again to, okay, so let's open this up. Let's have, how can we have good discourse? How can we have good conflict? How can we then commit to what we're going to do? How can then, what does that look like? And to some extent, that then leads to something called team charters. That's how do we do things? How does that align then with our values? So when we're doing something, even if we don't get to the absolute tip-top solution, is how we do it. And it's in line with, you know, one of our other heroes is obviously Simon Sinek, and he talks about what's your why. It's about how does that all work together. If you understand what your why is, then again that contextualizes the way in which you think about and then interact and behave in expressing that. So Carol Dweck is all about, you know, how do we focus our attention. And that's another thing that Dulcie and I love to talk about with clients is, you know, where the attention goes, the energy flows. That which is a bad paraphrase of Tim Robbins, who actually says it the opposite way around. But I actually prefer that where the attention goes, the energy flows. So that's actually what we're trying to do with top right thinking in many ways is to help us engage with tricky, difficult conversations that ultimately then lead to breakthroughs for you and for your teams, for your clients, for your customers, and for those that depend upon you. And you're absolutely right about, you know, the idea that, you know, it's difficult, which is kind of what I think you're alluding to. It's difficult, but it is, again, it's a process that is doable. And, you know, the whole thing about really doing this again as a team is that something that I love the phrase that a colleague of ours, Andrew Jenkins, calls I to the power of we. You know, this thing that we are supposed to be an incomplete autonomous unit. And well, that's not real life. The work that I do, particularly with healthcare professionals, vets and medics, is that they go through all this training to be perfectionists and to be autonomous and be able to answer all sorts of questions and be independent as a clinician. But actually, if anything, you know, healthcare is a classic example of wicked problems daily. Well, actually, it's about how you interact with each other. And then surrounding yourself, as you absolutely rightly put, you know, with people who are better than you and not being afraid of that. I mean, there's reasons why people, you know, like Richard Branson, you know, Elon Musk, and any Mark Zuckerberg, anybody you can cater think of who have made it in terms of, as these again, word made it in inverted commas, have surrounded themselves with people who are better than themselves. What are they masters of is unlocking that thinking and applying that thinking as a team. And that's where the magic happens, the I to the power of a we. When I win, we win. When we win, I win. What limits, I believe, so often is ego and I have to be irreplaceable or I have to be the one that can do exactly what other people are doing before asking them to do it. That is a nonsense, I suggest. But it is a quantum shift for many thinkers or many leaders.
Is that behavior built from childhood? Is it something that's formed early or is it something that's learned later in life?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we've spoken about in pre this recording is the idea is that, you know, so much of our brain's early life is very formative. And that's not to say, of course, that the brain can't be plastic throughout life. It is. It's plastic throughout its entire life. But there are certain phases in our life where we are particularly plastic. Neuroscience, psychologists, social scientists, psychiatrists, and sociologists would all agree, I think, that those first 3 years are particularly important. But there are other staging posts which are particularly important in development, particularly with guys, testosterone spikes, so usually ages 8 and 14 before later, obviously, sort of late teens. But all of these impact how the brain is developing. And the interesting thing is, you know, time and again, if you want to wire in curiosity, it's actually you can't tell somebody to be curious. You just can't. So allowing children to make mistakes, to value the process, whilst at the same time not just letting them off, just saying, oh, great job, you know, well done, love, and all that kind of thing. It doesn't work because children also are very savvy. I didn't do a very good job. But if you can have that high challenge, I can, and particularly the languages around not praising, because praising often is for the person who's giving it. You know, I want to feel better about it. I want to make my child feel better. It's actually going, I'm really impressed by or recognize the effort you put into that, you know, and again, then throwing in a lovely sort of top right question, you know, what would you do differently? Or what could you do differently? And not trying to rescue the child or the person that you're leading from that discomfort, the challenge of making the connections in one's own mind, because that way you're actually utilizing the neuroscience, neuroarchitecture of the brain to come up with a solution that's far more pertinent, far more salient to the child. And suddenly, if we're doing that repetitively, if we allow ourselves to have play time, and play can be all sorts of things here, and I'm not suggesting for a second that, you know, gaming doesn't have its place. In fact, there's a lot of research that gaming can be quite good, or very good in some cases, in terms of well-being and social interaction and solving problems. I mean, Minecraft is a great example of that, and the sort of societies and groups that as a result of that. But what we do know is throughout all of that phase, through our late teens into early 20s, we get this sort of neural pruning. There's a lovely neuroscientist who called Sarah Jane Blakemore, based in Cambridge, I believe. And she used to be in UCL, I think. And then she wrote a book called Inventing Ourselves. And in that book, she talks about this process of neural pruning as we get older. So as we get to that sort of late teens, early 20s, the ways in which we have come to think about problems, complex problems, productivity, what's important, actually get far more hardwired in. And I've really struggled with hardwired as a phrase for a number of reasons. So it's still plastic, it's just less plastic. And that's probably an evolutionary thing. It's about saying, actually, you know, if you've got to this point and your reproductive capacity is there, you're going to have enough information about how the world works to be successful enough that you can reproduce now. And then that's passing on those genes. But the beauty of the brain is that the next generation is beautifully capable of adapting to a new environment. The real trick here is to go, okay, well, how do we actually, again, get out of ourselves, get out of all the different biases that we have now had neural pruning, so the other options have been limited, reduced and limited, but not completely gone. Well, how do we do that? Well, we do that through seeing beyond our own perspective, our own paradigms, as Steve Covey would call it. And if anybody's listening who knows Steve Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, fantastic book. You know, it's about getting out of those paradigms. Well, that's to work with other people. It's about unlocking other people's thinking and a team's thinking. And again, this circles beautifully, I think, back to top right. You know, that's where time and again, you know, high challenge, high support. It's the combination, it's the paradoxical pairing of those things that are so important. And, you know, that is the sweet spot. And it takes practice. And is everyone can do it. You know, we are all plastic enough to be able to do that.
And you, when you were talking there about kind of the neuro pruning and challenging children at a young age and that kind of whole reward process, the phrase that kind of popped into my mind was wrapped in cotton wool. Is that a fair assumption that if you kind of do some of that conditioning, let's call it, you almost create that safe space, but there's no, when you fall, it feels a monumental fall, or when you fail, it feels a monumental fail because you're not conditioned or pruned that way?
100%. You're spot on. And again, it's not to say you can't learn that as you go through life, later in life.
But it must feel more painful.
Yes. And arguably, the stakes are higher, right? Because if you are at a certain point, you might have people that you're having responsibility for, dependents. That might be personal. That might be within a work context. So failing can be a lot more costly. And the fear of failing can be the thing that's the biggest hindrance, the biggest resistance, as it were, in one's head and as a team to actually having challenge. And it's that, I mean, it's unfortunate, but classic example would be sort of people like blockbusters who didn't see the ability to change beyond what they were already doing, which meant that, you know, Netflix survived and they didn't.
Yeah, I think, but they were offered, I think kind of the Netflix founders almost offered themselves to Blockbuster in the early days, didn't they?
Did.
Blockbuster kind of dismissed it, said, yeah, never take off and that's never going to work. And clearly... go try and visit your local Blockbuster today.
Quite. And I think, I mean, must say that, you know, hindsight's a beautiful thing, right? So for anybody who's listening that has had a Blockbuster experience themselves, you know, that's okay, but it's how we learn from it. And I would say that because I'm a coach, right? An eternal optimist, you know, it's what you've learned from it that's important. So,
And there's plenty of examples in there. I did a talk a couple of weeks ago at Nottingham University, and we used actually that Blockbuster example. We used Toys R Us because we were talking about purpose and how that steers you or doesn't to some degree. You know, Toys R Us, ultimately Amazon probably consumed a lot of that market. And a milkshake story we've just done as a blog as well, in terms of, I think it was McDonald's employed a lots of people to try and sell more milkshakes. And it was, you know, they tried the viscosity of it. They tried the flavor of it, the size of it, the price of it. Mm. Actually, what it was about was how long it lasted. So once they understood that it was single people that came in to buy the milkshake because they were using it to break up their commute, then they understood that those people only bought a milkshake so they could put a self-service milkshake machine in. And it was about how it tasted and how long it lasted for those individuals. So again, it's back to that curiosity and problem solving. And their initial assumption was, we need to do all these things, have more flavors to sell more, but they didn't understand the customer.
100%. There's a phrase that I love, which I don't think is an Aristotle quote, and I won't do it justice here, but it's assumptions are the mother of all F-ups.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And the best way of getting around that, the best way of getting out of your own thinking is to be curious and to ask curious questions. And the great thing about the top rope model as a concept here is that it's something you can do for yourself, you know, reflecting for yourself, you know, have I asked myself some tough questions, searching questions, or being honest with how I'm asking stuff of myself. I think one of the things that Dulcie and I, particularly when we're coaching, one of the biggest things that we can ask our clients to do, whether that's an individual or a group or a team, is to be honest with themselves. You know, I hadn't heard that milkshake quote, and I might want to sound really, you know, like I did. And part of me wants to know that, but it's not about that. It's going, actually, no, I don't know about that. Tell me more about that, Simon. And that's, I think, it's that humility to be okay with not knowing. And then, as you said, framing the attention onto, okay, what is it that I can learn from that? What can I learn from the way in which your brain's worked, that brain's worked, interpreted that? What does that then mean for me? And this reflexive phase is again, something that I think we, in today's world, particularly through lockdowns and then sort of online meetings that have gone back to back, we're not giving our brains enough time. And I'm as guilty as anybody right here of reflecting. So the brain, part of what the brain wants to do and needs to do with information is to sift through information and make creative leaps. That's really where it wants to do. It wants to, you know, brain is kind of like a pattern forming machine. It wants to be able to make connections so it can be more predictive in the future and more useful for you. And the back-to-back means that we're always in this sort of what neuroscientists would call task positive network mode, which is always forward focused, fast paced. But we need this sort of default mode network, which is kind of far more sort of, and it literally is a seesaw. It's, you know, proportionally, if you're that much more in sort of task positive mode, then you're not in as much in terms of default mode network sort of role. And the default mode is very much about how you're sitting back and being far less judgmental on how one makes decisions. And it allows you to make those sort of creative leaps. And you can sort of tailor that or tie that in with the way in which the brain operates and how it calms through things like meditation, or when you're doing something sort of fairly mundane, like driving or hoovering or cleaning one's teeth or sat in the loo even, or in the shower, and then suddenly a great idea pops into your head, a solution to something that you never thought, you know, where did that come from? And so I think that's the other thing I would sort of offer here. If you ever want me to back to have talk more about that, then by all means. But I think that's, again, how do we bring that into our day-to-day lives so that we have that reflective period, which allows our brains to make sense of things. Our brains are not computers. One of the things that Dulcie, I remember saying, which she likes exploring particularly, was that our brains are not computers. There are some analogies and metaphors that can be useful, but there's a lot that can't be useful as well. So how do we get reflective time? And one of the top tips I'd say here is, you know, there's a lovely Harvard Business Review study, or at least it was quoted in Harvard Business Review a number of years ago, talking about actually having 15 minutes at the end of a day where you might do some breathing activities, or you might, and just reflect basically on the course of the day, what had happened, what had worked. And that could include, you know, how many top right questions have I asked? And then what was amazing was when it compared to one group that had 15 minutes at the end of the day compared to a group that didn't have 15 minutes at the end of the day, productivity went up by 20% comparative. Right. Which, you know, that's a whole day. Now, this is where Dulcie and I, our raison d'etre, I suppose, is, you know, when we understand the neuroscience a bit more, not only are we getting greater productivity and results and connectivity, motivation, that whole energy, the retention, engagement with the team, that kind of run through walls levels of trust, but it's frankly enjoyable. And we would say that as Tiggers, we would say it's enjoyable. You would want to do it. And our brains get addicted on things that it likes to do, you know, get that lovely dopamine rush, as well as oxytocin rush in terms of being part of a trusting team. But, you know, that dopamine rush, and that's the reason why so many of us get addicted to, including myself, certain little, you know, games that we have on our phone, which give us these little rewards. That's the thing that that's what we help clients with. That's what we help leaders with. That's what we help teams with. When we start to have alignment in that sort of space, when we have trust, when we have the tools, the ability to understand the discomfort often in changing, as you said, moving from old ways of thinking to newer ways of thinking, which is completely accessible, I would say, to anybody, pretty much, including people with neurodiversity, which is another thing that we really love working with people with neurodiverse ways of thinking, the magic happens. And that, I believe, is the future of humanity. But I would say that because I'm a neuroscientist, and to a neuroscientist, all answers are about the brain and how it works, right?
Absolutely. So I think just to kind of draw it to a close, and I'm sure we could carry on this conversation for a good couple of hours, but maybe we do that offline and don't put the listeners through it. I think so the machines maybe aren't taking over. I know there's a lot in the news around potentially they're going to, and are we heading to this kind of Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator state? And I think the other big takeout for me is, you know, this is all a personal choice, isn't it? If you want to access this kind of stuff, there's lots of material. Clearly there's Dulcie, there's yourself that people can contact for further conversation. But all this is accessible at, you know, zero, relatively low cost, because it's all about a choice about thinking. Absolutely. Even that simple thing about giving yourself 15 minutes at the end of the day, there's, you know, you, if you've got an employer that's that barbaric and won't let you do that, there's probably a bigger question there. But I'm sure most forward-thinking organizations would relish that, see the importance, and then clearly take the productivity boost from it.
100%. I mean, and it's the classic again. I've worked with some companies, big organizations, where unfortunately there's a sort of waiver to the human, the European Works Directive, and that's really tricky, because it's all about, well, unless you are actually producing something, then you're not productive. And the science is completely opposite. You know, if you give people the value of time to think and recuperate, like lunch breaks, stay hydrated, that's another one, the return is incredible. And it's, and as to quote Dulcie's book, which is one of the reasons I loved it so much and still do, is it's not bloody rocket science, and yet it's not common practice. So absolutely, Simon, you're spot on. Some of these things are really so simple and yet not in place. What I would say, though, is quite often it's having a conversation with people, getting perspective like a coach that allows you, or a mentor, somebody to allow to go, okay, it's the intentional intervention, if you like, the strategic intervention that gives, you know, it's the right kind of intervention at the right time to the right amount. That's what gives you the results. And it's a bit like your story with the milkshakes. I think that's, again, it's just trying to work what that thing might be, and to set aside a requisite amount of time to see that thinking, that communication amongst each other, to come up with a strategy, at least, to the wicked problems that you're facing, that is going to, more, you know, the return on investment is phenomenal. And yet again, so often our brains want to lie to ourselves that we haven't got time. Or we've tried it before and it hasn't worked. Well, that's not true. It's not true. And we know that our brain lies to us all every day of the week. And again, that's, you know, one of the things that we try and help clients understand. And when they understand it's their biology and it's not them being lazy, and there's stuff, some very simple interventions you can do. And again, it's exploring, not us telling you what to do, but exploring what you can do to untap your thinking, to release your thinking, to ultimately elevate your thinking, communicating. Again, that's, again, return investment is huge.
Amazing. And we'll pause on that note. If people want to contact you or find out more, where's the best place for them to do that?
The best place is usually, well, there's two things. You can look at thinkitout.co.uk. That's the founding group that I've set up. It's a community and platform for coaches, trainers, and speakers. A phenomenal group of people. Again, very fortunate to have met some amazing people. And we're all about giving back as well. So much of what we do is to give back. And then the other place is obviously on LinkedIn. So Dr. Ian Price, PhD. So yeah, look, that's the best way of communicating with me. I get so many emails in the day, as you can imagine, with a number of different groups and people that I work with. DM me on LinkedIn is probably the best way of getting hold of me. So yeah, and you can obviously find our details as well. I think Dose, the book, you know, the 52 tips for, you know, better health and well-being, basically, and happiness, that I've written with Dulcie, details are in that as well. And if you want to go further on that, you can also look at the 52project.com as well. So you'll see me there.
Brilliant. We'll put links to all those in the show notes, just so people can click through and find you. Fascinating. I mean, absolutely fascinating. One of the most fascinating podcasts we've done to date, I think. So I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on, Simon. And we'll catch up soon.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you so much, Simon. Thanks for having me on. And we'll look forward to next time, maybe.